And I'm interested in the exotica of the universe, rather than putting me squarely in the extremely speculative realm. Actually, I now realize that I am not at the extreme end of speculation in this class. I'm the realist here. So.
I should have said real things that cannot be.
Anyway, so what I wanted to talk about today, before I sort of launch off, I would like to mention that please feel free to interrupt me along the way with questions, because I am going to try my best not to be jargony and not to assume that you'll know a lot of the observational data or the theoretical frameworks that I'm talking about. But, so feel free to stop me if you need any clarifications. Okay, so what I want to talk about is work that I've been doing on the growth of black hole masses over time, over cosmic time in the universe, in the context of the standard so-called lambda CDM paradigm for structure formation. So the model, which is a very successful model that describes the formation and growth of structure in our universe, that suggests that you have very small fluctuations in a nearly uniform dark matter density field at very early times. These inhomogeneities amplify, and there's a hierarchical growth and assembly of structures. And you have dark matter halos that collapse and assemble. And over time, they merge, and their concomitant components also merge. So you have dark matter halos that host the formation of galaxies. And in the centers of these galaxies, you have the black holes. So we're going to talk about an overarching framework that fits into the hierarchical merging picture for dark matter halos, but then allows us to make sense of how the black holes that are hosted in them grow along with the growth of the dark matter halo and mergers of galaxies. And so the goal is to really build a storyline. And I use that word very deliberately because there are many unknowns. And it's, you know, the field is really evolving very rapidly with new data that has become available. So here's a very brief outline. And I want to motivate the work, why it's interesting, and why are we now able to actually evolve and have an understanding of the buildup of massive black holes from very early epochs in the universe to today. So I want to give a little bit of motivation, and it's primarily observational motivation. Then I'll show you how accretion histories are constructed, how these models, theoretical models, are constructed, what the observational constraints are on those models at very early epochs as well as recent epochs. And I'll be focusing on three particular issues. So these have been problems that I've been working on over the past few years that are now have many loose ends have sort of come together, and we have some very nice new results on three different topics. One is a new channel for producing the first black hole seeds. So these are the first astrophysical black hole seeds that start off the whole process of the growth of black holes. Then evidence for so this new mechanism for forming massive black hole seeds, and how that automatically actually allows you to calculate theoretically, and is now borne out by observations, that there is evidence for some upper mass limit for black holes at every epoch in the universe. And then if I have time, I want to touch upon this, because this is a direction that I do want to go in the future. So, and I've done some preliminary work, sort of simulations of trying to understand electromagnetic counterparts to the gravitational wave signature you would get from the merger of binary black holes. So there's been recent advances in numerical relativity, and simulations of numerical relativity and mergers of black holes are phenomenal. But what is interesting is that any future mission like LISA, while you would detect the gravitational waves, you wouldn't be able to pinpoint where the waves are coming from. So you need electromagnetic counterparts that could signal where the mergers are happening. So people like me have been working on trying to compute what these electromagnetic counterparts could be. Would you see huge infrared emission, X-ray emission from these regions, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously variability, and so on and so forth. So if I have time, I will get to that. Before I move on, I want to thank several of my collaborators, some students, a postdoc of mine, and some other colleagues with whom I've done work over the past few years on many of these topics. So let me quickly point out the approach to building accretion histories that has been followed before I start showing you some of the observational motivations. Is there a pointer? Oh, wow. Okay. No wonder everyone's sitting further back. Now I get it. Okay, so normally what is done is we do sort of a globally, there are sort of globally average constraints. So constraints that you obtain averaging over time in the universe. So the most important one was derived by Soltan in 1982, where he looked at the blue light that is emitted by quasars, and quasars are thought to be powered by accretion onto black holes, by the entire population of quasars. So you detect quasars with a luminosity function at different epochs in the universe. So then he assumed that if you integrate the entire blue light, the emission from these quasars over time, over redshift, then and assume a constant accretion efficiency for accretion onto black holes, you can calculate the total energy density in accretion onto black holes in the universe. So this is an integral constraint. So another approach, so that's a very, very important constraint because you are seeing individual quasars, but you know you're detecting these populations over time. So this gives you a constraint on any model that you build for how accretion occurs onto black holes. The other very sort of important piece in assembling the accretion history is in addition a continuity argument that allows you to go from epoch to epoch. So this is a globally average constraint. And then you need a model that allows you to follow the progression of accretion. And this argument was first made by Small and Blanford in a paper in 1992. And what this really means is they provided a way to hook up the formation of structure, hierarchical formation of structure, and inserting black hole growth as an essential feature of that hierarchical process. So both of these approaches have now been combined, and they offer very powerful constraints, as you will see. So let me move on to the observation. Yeah? Yeah?
The phi, is that the same as the E of L?
Pardon?
I'm confused about the relation.
Yeah, this is L phi.
That's phi up there, right?
Yeah. L times phi. So the observational, so there's been a sphere of observational data, and in a lot of the conversations I've had with people so far, since morning, I've been telling you that the wealth of data in astrophysics and cosmology has been overwhelming in the past decade. So while theorists had a much easier, sort of cushier job, say 10 years ago, like my advisor, I always like to say that Martin Rees had a much easier time than we all do because he could sit on the fence and write a paper, you know, arguing both sides of the coin. And now you just can't do that anymore. There's too much data, so you can't really not make up your mind. I mean, you have constraints and, you know, it's very hard to build theories that actually satisfy all the different constraints that are now available. Anyway, the wealth of observational data has produced some very, very surprising results, at least in the field of black holes. But you see these very strong correlations, I want you to focus on the middle panel here, between the mass of the central massive object, which is the black hole, versus the velocity dispersion of the dark matter halo that is hosting, or the galaxy, the stellar component of the galaxy in the innermost regions. So this is the velocity dispersion of the stars in the innermost region, which is also related to the mass of the dark matter halo that hosts the whole galaxy and the black hole. It's a pretty tight correlation. Okay, just focus on the black points. For astrophysics, this is a very tight correlation. Yep.
Version where the velocity curve is flat, or in the inner region where it's not flat?
It's still not flat, but this is the velocity dispersion that's measured within the effective radius of the galaxy. So
what,
if you look,
what does that mean?
What does that mean? It's the innermost region. So if you look at the intensity distribution of the light in galaxies, so intensity as a function of a radius falls off very sharply. It's some kind of exponential, and there is an effective radius. Just the innermost region,
yeah,
of an exponential r to the quarter, e to the r over r, e to the quarter kind of law.
So that's, what I'm asking is that far enough out that you expect that dark matter is dominating?
No, the dark matter does not dominate at this point. So this is a reflection of the stellar component entirely. However, we have ways to relate this quantity to the properties of the dark matter halo. Okay, that is underpinning of all these models, because I'm trying to put them in the framework of the growth of dark matter Hilbert structure. So there's a pretty strong correlation between these two properties that suggests that the formation of the black hole has some connection to the formation of the stars in the galaxy, and is somewhat critical to the assembly of the galaxy itself, okay, the assembly of the black hole. And this, you know, these measurements for the black hole masses have been obtained from a variety of methods, one of which is looking at the dynamics, looking at the velocity dispersion of stars in the inner regions of these galaxies, for example. So what this suggests is that there is a link between the star formation and black hole assembly. So the other piece of observational evidence which is intriguing and needs to be explained is the abundance and the luminosity function of quasars, which are detected in the optical. I will be calling the accreting black holes seen in the optical as quasars, and those detected in the X-ray as AGN. Okay, so there are all these sort of nomenclature issues, but that's the convention. So the abundance and the luminosity function of quasars at very, very high redshift. So after the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, using very clever filters, was able to isolate a population of very, very bright quasars at redshifts of 6. So this is about 2 giga-years since the Big Bang, right? So this is very early times. And it turns out these quasars are so bright that if our current accretion paradigm is correct, it implies that black holes with masses of about 1 billion solar masses already exist at this point. Again, you'll see why this is a key feature in requiring a major rethink in some of our original ideas. And of course, observationally, we are also detecting a handful of binary black holes in the process of merging. So the most sort of popular candidate is NGC 6240, where you see these two double nuclei in the X-ray, and the separation is about a kiloparsec. So it appears that merging activity with black holes is correlated with the merging of the galaxies. Okay, so when galaxies merge, their black holes also merge.
What's the mass of these black holes?
In this one, it's a few times, the estimates are that it's a few times 10 to the 6 and a few times 10 to the 7 for the two different ones. And there's also some evidence, claimed evidence from the deep survey, that you are detecting some binaries. It's a little more speculative, but I think it's a very, very interesting observation. So you're detecting merging, the presence of merging black holes. So merging is a feature that you probably see in the X-ray, the radio, and in the optical. So the other window that we have for a more complete census of black holes is the X-ray waveband, because you're no longer obscured by dust. Because in the optical, you can't get a complete census of quasars because of dust. Okay, you don't, they're obscured, you may not detect them in the optical. So to get a more complete census, X-rays are really the way to go. And over the past few years, with Chandra and all the X-ray satellites, we have a very, very good understanding of the number of accreting sources as a function of flux and the redshift distribution of those sources. What is interesting about these accreting black holes in the X-ray is the integrated emission from these holes actually constitutes an X-ray background, a diffuse background that comes from actually these discrete sources distributed in redshift. And we actually have a very good measurement of the X-ray background, and we have a nice explanation of the distribution in redshift of the kinds of accretors that are needed to explain that spectrum. Okay, and it appears that we need some obscured AGN, a very large fraction of obscured AGN, and some unobscured AGN to explain the X-ray background. So we have a census of black holes in the optical, we have a census of black holes in the X-ray, and we also have a census, a rough idea of the number of black holes that are actually caught merging. And the correlations between the observed properties of galaxies and central black holes suggests, as I said earlier, an intimate relationship between the physics of star formation and the physics of black hole assembly. So there has been a lot of modeling. So this is the accretion rate on the black holes. So that is shown here. And this is the star formation rate. This is all globally averaged quantities now. This is using the globally averaged argument over a function of over redshift. And what you see, these dates, these dots are data points from X-ray surveys. And you find that they kind of do in a globally averaged way. They do mirror each other. Okay, so this peaks. Well, that's not surprising, right? Because the same gas that powers the accretion onto black holes is required to make stars. So it's not surprising. However, okay, so the current, so let me just lay down. So if anyone falls asleep after this, this is sort of the summary of the accretion history. But so you start, how do you build an accretion history for a population of black holes? You start out with a mass function of C black holes. Then you generate a Monte Carlo merger tree consistent with the merger rates in a cold dark matter universe. And then you propagate the different black hole seed models down to redshift zero and calculate as you go along that, you know, when the halos merge, you assume galaxies merge, the black holes merge, and then there's some accretion. At every epoch, whenever you merge, there's some gas brought into the center, it merges, and you could see it as a quasar, you would see it as an X-ray source, and so on and so forth. So there have been groups and groups of people who've been doing this as a business for a very, very long time. And the idea is that we incorporate, as time goes on, we've been incorporating newer and newer pieces of data that provide constraints at every step. As I said, one of the key constraints came with the detection of the very bright, optically bright quasars at redshift 6. So let me now jump to the three specific topics in the accretion history that I want to focus on. So the first is the pathways to making black hole seeds. So the this is an old diagram from one of Martin Rees's papers where there are many pathways to making black hole seeds in the early universe. And I'm going to pursue the path that has been most most popular has been the formation of a single star, of a single first star, and its remnant. So the first star was likely a more massive star because there were not many metals to cool. So you form these 500-ish solar mass objects, which then burn their fuel and end up as a few hundred, say 100 solar mass black hole. And then you propagate down that mass with accretion on with every epoch, with every merger. You accrete some gas on and you follow the accretion history. So those were the seeds that, yeah.
So to what extent, and I'm sure a lot of us will have questions which you can rule out as irrelevant, but to what extent does the distribution of initial seeds of 500 solar mass stars probe the small scale properties of the dark matter? Is whether there are cusps and...
It doesn't probe whether there are cusps or not, but what it does probe is the abundance of the high significance peaks and the fluctuations.
Yeah.
So it turns out that you require a certain fraction to be six sigma peaks, five sigma and six sigma peaks, to produce enough first stars, to produce enough black hole seeds, and to produce enough metals to enrich the IGM at later times.
So
there are constraints not on the detailed radial properties of the dark matter halos, but there are on the abundance of the high significance peaks.
And is that is what you
that
need?
That fits.
Is what you need consistent with what we know about lambda CDM to get
yeah.
that?
Yeah. But the problem is not so much that the numbers don't match. As I'll show a little later, one of the problems that they have discovered recently in these simulations of the formation of first stars in a group led by Tom Abel and others at Stanford is that the first star, when it does form the black hole, when the black hole forms, it's likely to get ejected out of the dark matter halo rather than nicely seed.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the first stars might not be the best candidate for making the seeds. So you need other ways to make seeds. Which, you know, I was rather happy to hear about because, you know, that bandwagon has been ridden for quite a while and it's time to open ourselves to other new channels. So the channel of from direct formation of black hole seeds that me and my postdoc have worked on for a while is the sort of direct formation in the centers of accretion disks. So I'll just come to that model in a bit and give you a quick idea of how the earlier picture for how seeds were formed. So as I said, it would be from the remnants of first stars, which are referred to as population 3 stars, and you would get seeds. You know, the actual masses of these first stars is very poorly determined. We just think that they're between a few hundred to a thousand solar masses, so there's a bit of ambiguity about what the mass scale would be for the remnant black hole, but it's just a few hundreds of solar masses. And And what is interesting is that this, starting off with a few hundred solar masses, it is very, very hard to even grow a small fraction of them to a billion solar masses by redshift 6. Okay, you have to resort to rather inelegant, extreme possibilities in radiation physics to make that happen. So that was motivation for coming up with new channels. So the other kinds of mechanisms that have been suggested for the direct formation of black hole seeds would give you more massive seeds to start out with, 10 to the 3 to about 10 to the 6 solar mass seeds. And so the idea that we have developed further was a slightly more sophisticated model that built on earlier ideas from Eisenstein and Loeb and Carl Schiffers et al., who basically you have an accretion disk which offers the most efficient way for angular momentum transfer. So you have gas that assembles into an accretion disk, and there are instabilities that drive gas to the center, that drive mass to the center and angular momentum out. And you can concentrate quite a lot of mass in the center. The question is, how dynamically stable is that object? So you need to make simulations, which is what we did, to see how much mass you can funnel to the center before you actually fragment the disk. And how long will the disk be stable for? What are the conditions of temperature and density for the gas that you would need to, in order to actually get this runaway collapse going? Okay? So that is the model that we've looked at, and I'll just mention some of the details. There have been some other models where people have looked at instabilities in supermassive stars that actually do form a star, which is much more massive than the traditional population 3 star, then therefore would end up giving you a more massive remnant. And you know, there have been claims, nobody has ever made a central accreting object in a full-blown cosmological simulation yet. Okay, you have to insert a set of sink particles that you call black holes, you know, constituting a black hole and so on. So this is just to show you that, you know, there are enough locations, if you look at a representative volume of the universe at a redshift 15.5 or so, of these locations where you see the red dots, you actually have enough high significance peaks that could see the formation of these seed black holes. So let me quickly now give you a brief description of our model, which I said, you have baryons that are inside a dark matter halo that collapse to form a rotationally supported disk. It's a pre-galactic disk, so there are no metals, right? It's not enriched. And the only coolants that you have available for the gas at this point are either molecular hydrogen or atomic hydrogen, okay? We don't actually know in every individual halo which is going to be available, but that's it. Those are the only two coolants that you have. So the disk can become gravitationally unstable. It will start accreting to the center. You'll start piling mass to the center, and you'll assemble a black hole. As I said earlier, so the question is, how stable is this disk? What is the fate of such an object? And is it stable? And how long is it stable for? And what the final mass of such an object would be? Now, it turns out that about 5% of the dark matter halos at redshift 10 to 15 can actually host a black hole of 10 to the 5 solar masses. So we can make a black hole of about 10 to the 5 solar masses in about 5% of the dark matter halos. Remember, I told you that Rob, in trying to explain the number of observed quasars, you know, the black holes that are that explain the number of quasars seen at redshift 6, is this percentage. And 5% works beautifully to explain the population that is seen. It's the angular momentum. I'll just get to it in a minute. So basically, as I said, we don't know what the coolant is. So depending on what the coolant is, atomic or molecular hydrogen, you can end up with a disk that's either hot at about 4,000 Kelvin or about 400 Kelvin. And you might say, well, why are you calculating? It's very important to see whether these conditions are actually applicable to the early universe. As it turns out, they are. And there, you know, there are sites available, enough sites available in the dark matter distribution that can seed a disk, a hot disk, or a cold disk. And then what we do in these simulations, we actually follow the fate of these disks to see how stable they are, when they fragment, what are the conditions under which they fragment. And so it turns out that the crucial factor is the ratio of the virial temperature of this halo, right? And that the virial temperature, if you will, is proportional to sort of the kinetic energy of the dark matter particles that constitute the halo, and the temperature of the gas. So it's the ratio of that that really determines the fate, the dynamical fate of this disk. in addition to the angular momentum of this halo. Okay, because the angular momentum of the halo is crucial, because the angular momentum of the halo determines how efficiently you assemble the disk in the first place. Okay, and how big your disk is, and what the scale height of that disk is. Now, we can calculate quite easily from the standard lambda CDM abundance of halos of a given mass at any epoch, folding in the angular momentum distribution, the spin distribution of halos. So it appears, in at least in numerical simulations of structure formation, it appears that the spin distribution is just a measure of the angular momentum, distribution of dark matter halos follows a log normal distribution. Okay, and we know what that distribution is, and you can fold that in. As I said, the spin distribution is relevant and important because that determines how efficiently you can even assemble the disk in the first place. So we find that the properties of the final mass of the black hole seed are very neatly coupled to the properties of the dark matter halo, its spin, its mass, as well as the gas temperature. Okay, so we have a new and interesting way of deriving a mass function, because we know the dependencies on the dark matter halo mass and the spin. So it turns out, as I said, this ratio of virial to gas temperatures is critical, and depending on what that value is, there's sort of these, roughly the three regimes. And these are the three regimes of interest, and we follow them through, right? In an ensemble of halos, you will have some in this regime, some in this regime, and some in this regime of a given spin. Okay, so that's what we track in the end. So you find that there, one scenario is that you'll fragment and you will form stars, and you just don't assemble any central object at all. So you don't form a seed. So there'll be a subpopulation of halos where you just don't form a seed. Then there'll be a population where you will form both stars and a central mass. And for all these scenarios, we can actually calculate the mass, roughly the mass that goes into the central object and the mass that forms stars, fragments and forms stars. And then there's a third case, which is a maximally efficient case, the central seed formation, where you don't fragment ever, you're very stable, and you funnel a lot of mass to the center. Yeah. No, we don't.
No metal feedback at all. Cooling function.
Same cooling function. Yeah. And the justification we give for that is the whole process is so fast that if we take into account the lifetime of a star and so on, the central mass is assembled well before the stars live to give you feedback on the gas.
Yeah. Question, just another question. What's the key quantity that determines when this process starts? That is around Z of 10 or 15 rather than 50 or 70 or something?
I think it's the collapse. It's the collapse and the virialization of the first dark matter halos, the most significant peaks. So it's when the values are collapsed.
Ultimately, it's delta rho over rho.
It is delta rho over rho. Ultimately, it is delta rho. Yeah.
But the mass, its mass peaks above a certain threshold.
Yeah, above a certain threshold. Obviously, as I said, number so what, 5 and 6 sigma peaks.
Yeah, but even mass scale.
Yeah, the mass scale, 10 to the 6 solar mass halos at a redshift of 15 to 20. Mm-hmm. So that's the mass of the dark matter halo. So the typical dark matter halo that is going to seed one of these massive seeds is about, and this is at a redshift of 15 to 20. It doesn't matter much. There's not a whole lot of time there, so roughly that. And these will range. So these are definitely greater than 3.5 sigma peaks. So what we were able to do is, for the first time, we were actually able to predict a mass function for seed black holes. Okay, and this hasn't been done before, because the earlier seeds were basically a delta function, right? There were 100 solar masses at redshift of 10. That's what you start out with. So here what we have is a very physically motivated model that tells you that you can have a mass function, a distribution of seed masses, right? And so this is the mass function. And so the earlier work, which did not follow the dynamically the evolution of the pre-galactic disk, and therefore did not worry about the possibility of fragmentation, right? That's more optimistic scenario than in reality. That predicts a mass function that looks like some kind of Gaussian. Okay, that's earlier work. And what we find is that if you take the dynamics into account, you know, there are these three possible regimes. So there's only one regime that's maximally efficient. There are other regimes where you fragment and form a mass, central mass, and also fragment into stars along the way. So we find the tapering sort of a cutoff. So when we include fragmentation, we find this cutoff. And so this is calculated at redshift 20. So this is the mass function that we predict at redshift 20. And the solid line and the dashed lines offer slightly different criteria, stability criteria for the disk. Okay, it's kind of irrelevant. They're different Q values for those of you who know tomb race stability criteria. It's a question of when you assume that the onset of instabilities, basically, that will start fragmenting the disk. So it doesn't make that much of a difference, but you see that there is a difference in the mass spectrum of black hole seeds depending on whether you're coolant is atomic or molecular hydrogen. So if you have a cold disk, you have sort of a sharper cutoff. You don't make as many massive seeds. But note that this is a slice through a diagram, right? I already told you that there's another important parameter, which is the spin of the halo, and I have not showed that here. So let me show you what it looks like. So there's a fragmentation threshold. So as spin, lower spin halos can more efficiently form black hole seeds. But what is different in our model is that some high spin halos in which the temperature criterion is satisfied will also form seeds. They may not be the most massive seeds, but they will still form seeds. Okay, that's what is different from other models, earlier work. So earlier work assumed that it's always only the low spin distribution of dark matter halos that will seed the formation of the first black holes. So our work has shown that because it's a combination of two factors, the spin of the dark matter halo plus the ratio of the virial temperature to the gas temperature, there will be some halos in which the ratio of the virial temperature to the gas temperature will allow you to form a seed even in a high spin halo. Okay, it'll be a less massive seed, but you'll still fall them. And that's a very, very important distinction because that increases the number of dark matter halos that are actually seeded, okay, at very early epochs. You don't need to seed every 5 sigma peak at redshift 20 to explain the local demography of black holes. You can actually seed every 10th. Every 10th 5 sigma peak, and you can still explain the demography works out. But the critical thing is the mass distribution, whether you can get the mass spectrum right. And we find that you need to have some lower mass seeds, more, slightly more inefficient seeds as well, to explain some very special features that are observed at low redshift. And I'll just come to that in a minute. So this is just the mass function for those three different stability criteria. And you find this is the mass function, this histogram, so this is just a number versus black hole mass, log black hole mass. And so there's a maximally efficient model which corresponds to Q equals 3 for seed. So this is once again at redshift of 15. So now let me quickly jump to what people actually do with these seeds. You know, how do you construct accretion history? So the popular role, the strongest bandwagon at the moment is the idea that major mergers of galaxies trigger major growth episodes for black holes. Okay, and that's a model that Lars Hernquist and his group have been vigorously following and pushing. And I think I mentioned to a couple of people over conversations, it turns out this is a nice picture and they have a fully developed framework for showing what kind of features you would have if you had black holes in the centers of galaxies when they merge and so on. But you know, unfortunately, it turns out in the real universe, in the lambda CDM paradigm, major mergers are a very small fraction of all mergers. The majority of mergers in a lambda CDM universe are minor mergers. So this could not be the whole story. It could be a story for a small subset of massive halos that are merging with other equally massive halos. Okay, and or two very gas-rich, massive galaxies merging with each other. However, the utility of these simulations is that it allows you to develop a set of scaling laws. Okay, because remember, we are deriving all these empirical observed correlations, and what you want is to start ab initio the set of simulations from which you can extract some scaling laws that either match or don't match the observed correlations. And what is interesting is that they can actually match a lot of the observed correlations. Of course, they have parameters, and you know, they're tuned to match. They can match them, and they make predictions. And those predictions can be tested. And it's a little early to say, you know, they're not holding up as well at the moment, but you know, more data is awaited before we have the final word on it. So what is the story here? The story is that you have a merger, and you have two galaxies. They have a first passage, they have a second passage. They are still seen as multiple nuclei, and this shows you the gas, and this shows you the stars in the galaxies that are merging. And you find that accretion onto the black hole, they merge, and the accretion onto the black hole is triggered for a very short period. Okay, a lot of gas flows into the center, and you have a huge accretion episode, and the black holes grow immensely in this very small epoch. Okay? And at the end of it, you have this one single remnant, and that matches the properties. But it turns out for all these models, you also need so much gas flows into the simulations in the centers of these galaxies that you would form a huge number of stars, even though you blow out quite a lot of gas. And it turns out that number, that sort of quantity, the star formation rate that is predicted in this sort of simple simulation isn't really observed. So it turns out that regardless of whether it's major mergers or not, it appears that we need some kind of self-regulation, some kind of radiative physics that controls the amount of gas that is accreted onto the black hole. So it turns out that we proposed a model in 1998 in a paper where we looked at, we calculated that there's an upper limit to the mass of black holes that can form in a halo with a given velocity dispersion and a given spin value. Okay, so there's an upper limit, and it's a function of epoch. Okay, because this is a function implicitly of Z. Okay, in the cold dark matter picture, as I said, the mass assembly immediately gives you a function of Z here. So at every epoch, we theoretically predicted that there should be some kind of limit. Okay, and this is required in the models for a variety of other reasons, you know, aside from just what radiative physics suggests. And this is just to quickly show you the, you know, I'm going on and on about merging, and you'll say, okay, well, how important is this? How many mergers do you have? So if you have a black hole of 10 to the 7 solar masses, or 10 to the 6 solar masses, like one in the Milky Way, this is how the mass is built up, okay, over time. So this is from redshift 20. You start from a seed of like a few hundred solar masses, and then you get bumped up. And the interesting thing is you get bumped up not because of the merger with another black hole, but the accretion activity that that merger triggers. Okay, so the principal growth of black holes is by accretion of gas. It's not by the actual merger of those black holes, as it turns out. Okay, so here is a comparison of the predictions. So it turns out if you seed with population 3 seeds, with the remnants of the first stars, then you predict this observed correlation. So what you see as crosses here are the data points, right, with error bars. This is the same correlation I showed you when we started, which is the mass of the black hole versus the velocity dispersion measured within the effective radius of the galaxy, right? And I told you it was a tight correlation. So if you have population 3 seeds and you follow them all the way down to redshift 0, this is what you predict. Notice you predict a lot of very low mass black holes in in galaxies with very low velocity dispersions. Okay? Whereas look at our other seeding models with more massive seeds, which I think are in better agreement with the data, because we actually do not produce as many low mass black holes. Okay, of course, you know, at the moment, this is an evolving situation, right? It's very, very hard. These measurements, the measurements to fill in here are very hard. And we need to wait and see if this cutoff that we see is actually instrumental limitations at the moment on systematics or whether it's real. But this is our prediction. So our model predicts that for, you know, these various efficiencies, and you know, we can tweak the parameters in our model are basically this onset of instability for that accretion disk. So we find that, you know, we make a very concrete prediction at zero redshift on the low mass end of the black hole mass function. That there's a cutoff, you don't have very many low mass So one of the other predictions that our model makes, our model also predicts, so what you've shown here in the data points, the dashed line here is the data. So this is the X-ray luminosity function. So we can predict, so the measurements stop at some luminosity at the moment at these redshift bins, and we predict the faint end now of the luminosity function, okay, which is going to become accessible with a new set, with the next generation X-ray satellites. Okay, so we can predict what the faint end looks like. And notice we match reasonably well the bright end that is currently seen. So we're in agreement with the current data, and we are making these predictions for what the faint end slope ought to be. Okay, but it all turns over. In all our models, it turns over. It doesn't keep going. Okay, it turns over. So even at the low mass end, one could argue that our model is suggesting some kind of limit as well, both from the fact that the luminosity function is turning over and from the plot that I showed you earlier when I showed there was a cap on the lowest mass black holes that you produce. What is really interesting is, so this is the local black hole mass function. So this is the number of black holes per unit volume in mass bins is a function of black hole mass. This black curve is roughly our current observational estimate. And that comes from, that is the, it's folded in by using the correlation that is seen in black hole mass and the sigma. And from cold dark matter, from the assembly of halos, we know what the distribution of sigmas is over time. So we can fold that in, and we produce this observed black hole mass function. Of course, it has error bars that I've not shown you here. And the three models, our three models, predict two interesting features, as we showed earlier. There's a small bump that we predict around 10 to the 6 solar masses, and then we under-predict the low mass compared to today's observations, right? There's a cutoff. And we see something very interesting in the upper mass bin. So now let's focus on the upper limit. So remember I told you that theoretically you expect from radiative physics that there ought to be some kind of upper mass limit. So now looking at the X-ray data as a function of redshift and building the accretion history, we find that the only way to actually match the observed local black hole mass function with our accretion history is to impose a self-regulated cutoff at the bright end of the luminosity function, of the X-ray luminosity function. There is no other fix that will change the slope and allow it to match this. It turns out that if you make a more sophisticated model with more parameters and stuff, you just cannot fit the combination, because you have to fit both the amplitude and the slope of this curve. Yep.
What is self-regulation?
We think, so the proposal is that since a small fraction of the rest mass energy of the accreted gas is converted into X-rays that you see, that at some point the X-ray, the luminosity of the X-rays and the energy in the X-rays exceeds the binding energy of the accretion disk. So you unbind the disk entirely and you evacuate the central region of gas. So it's, you know, you just don't have gas supply. You've disrupted the gas supply in the center.
Would that be visible in any other way, the evacuation event?
Well, the way it would be visible, I mean, we couldn't do it at high redshifts, but for example, at the center of our galaxy, so I would argue that the black hole at the center of our galaxy, which is gas poor, has reached its limit. And it turns out, of course, it has, because we have the relevant quantities that we have measured, and we have a rough estimate of what the spin we think for the halo that hosts the Milky Way is. So, you know, the nearby universe where we've seen shut off holes that have reached their limit, we do see the centers to not have much gas.
This is just a correlation between gas poor and high mass.
Yeah. Not necessarily high mass, because you could cut off. Remember, the upper limit depends on the epoch. And you could, so at a given redshift, you reach a certain limiting mass. And then if there is a merger at a later time, you inject some gas into the system, then you have a new upper limit to which you can grow. Okay? So what do we predict? So we predict the existence of a small fraction of ultramassive black holes. And ultramassive is anything in excess of 5 × 10⁹ solar masses. And we can also predict, because we know what these correlations are, we can actually predict what the sites are. Where are these ultramassive black holes? Right. So it turns out that the correlations between the black hole mass, and I showed you, remember I showed you three panels in the correlation, the observational correlations. One of the panels also showed the magnitude, the B magnitude, in a restricted visible wavelength of the magnitude of the bulge, or bulge stars, and there's a strong correlation with that as well. So what we predict is this handful of ultramassive black holes that we ought to produce, that number is capped, because there are, you know, there's a, we know their number because they've reached their limit, right, at redshift zero. And they would be in excess of 5 × 10⁹ solar masses, and they would be at the centers of the brightest galaxies in the centers of nearby clusters. Okay, so that's the prediction. And it turns out that it is borne out quite well, because the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has come up with a number of candidates, and the number of candidates that they predict is in excellent agreement at the moment with the number that we predict. So this was a joke that was absolutely not gotten on the west coast of the United States. So let us see if it works here. I'm very bad at jokes. I just can't do them in talks, and I've been trying very hard to sort of appear to be this more relaxed, jokey person. It's not working. So where are the local ultramassive? This is, of course, Manhattan, and that's Wall Street, right? Where are the most massive, ultramassive black holes in our nearby universe? They're actually not in the centers of bright nearby elliptical galaxies that are the centers of clusters, but actually on Wall Street. But anyway, that, I mean, I just assumed somehow that people on the West Coast didn't even understand it was Manhattan. And I was like, oh, but so it didn't work. But I'm glad it worked here. But then it helped that I gave you the school. So I realized you're sort of warm up people. So now moving on to the second one. How am I doing on time? Oh my God. Okay. So what I want to talk about a little bit again is a very interesting simple and elegant calculation, if I may say so myself, that Phil Armitage and I did, in which we worried about, so in all these accretion models, right, the models that I'm building originally, we assumed that when galaxies merge, in that episode, you're triggering accretion, right? And we assumed that the actual merger of those black holes occurs instantaneously. The question is, how long does it take? I mean, and you know, it's very important to know if it's going to take a Hubble time for them to actually merge, then you know, our picture is not holding up too nicely, right? There'll be a lot of hangups. There won't be as much growth as we predicted. So what we wanted to do was to look at, do a simulation, as good a simulation as we could, of having a large gas disk and inserting two black holes, one in the center, and one plowing in from the periphery as a result of a merger, coplanar, the simplest situation, and see how long it takes for them to merge. And the question here is, you know, it's quite controversial in astrophysics, you know, because nobody knows if the way to merge black holes, what are the mechanisms that are required to merge them? You have to lose the angular momentum in that orbit of that binary for this hole to actually reach the center. And just the stellar component enough, just, you know, the scattering off the stars is not efficient enough to drag you all the way in to the point where gravitational radiation driven in spiral will take over. So there's a radius, there's a critical radius of about 10 to the minus 4 parsecs or so, at which point for a 10 to the 7 solar mass black hole and 10 to the 6 solar mass pair, that gravitational radiation losses would be a very efficient way to lose angular momentum. But you have to get them down to that close. So it turns out stellar dynamical processes are not as efficient as we would like. So these are, you know, this was called the bottleneck, the last parsec hangup, and so on. So we thought that one efficient way to lose angular momentum is obviously this. So we said, well, there are disks in the centers of a lot of massive galaxies, so let's see what happens if the gas in the disk can actually drive the merger much more efficiently. So we did this simulation. And the reason for looking at this particular scenario was to, as I said earlier in the introduction, want to understand also if there are any electromagnetic counterparts, right? The electromagnetic counterparts are going to come only if there's gas. So the idea was to see what we could actually accomplish with a simple simulation of what kind of, what are the stages of such a gas-driven merger, and what observational signatures you could have for each of those stages. And so, you know, the motivation for the potential observational signatures, if you had gas, or you could have some delayed X-ray rebrightening when all the, when the two black holes are merged and the leftover gas is very rapidly accreted onto the merged black hole, or if a disk is actually doing is assisting the merging by helping you lose angular momentum, then can you see any features in variability in the disk and so on and so forth. So these are, you know, open questions that we wanted to investigate. So the whole procedure, so there's a very interesting physical process in viscous accretion disk, which is very obvious, which is why the disk is a useful sink of angular momentum. So you have a central black hole, the primary that's sitting somewhere here. This is a cross-section of the accretion disk. And this is the secondary that is moving through. It turns out that the tidal torques, the compression from the secondary landing on the accretion disk, it opens up a gap in the accretion disk. Okay? And the gap is opened up, you see, for a range of accretion disk properties, assumed properties of the accretion disk. So the key property for the accretion disk that you have to assume is viscosity, is the viscous stress. And you know, there is a model, there's a Shakura-Sunyaev model, which we don't have a microphysical theory of how viscosity works. But we have a phenomenological model that allows us to parameterize the viscous stress in terms of a parameter called alpha. Okay? So alpha is roughly between 1% and a few percent. And what we find is that the disk-driven merger, let me just show you this movie. I think it's working. So you see the secondary here, plowing through the center, and then the center has been extracted. So there is no real black hole there, but you know, it's been extracted for numerical convenience. And what you see is that you set up spiral density waves in this disk. So this is the top view, and you see the secondary migrating into the center, and you see this gap opening up. So this gap is a gap in the surface mass density. So I'll just show you a plot that, so you're literally disengaging dynamically the inner part of the accretion disk, because the time scales become very different for the inner part of the accretion disk and the outer part of the accretion disk. You disconnect them, essentially. Okay? And so the goal here is to, as I said, arrive at the separation, at a critical separation, at which gravitational wave losses will take over the loss of angular momentum as a primary process, right? And so that's critical radius. You can calculate what that critical radius is as a function of parameters, disk parameters, that alpha that I mentioned, and q, which is the mass ratio of the primary and the secondary, and the disk scale height of the disk. So it depends on the properties that you assume for the accretion disk. So h over r is the vertical scale length. The h is the vertical scale length, and this is r, the radius of the disk. So it turns out that this works. Works quite well. And it turns out the reason why the gravitational wave driven spiral is faster and more efficient is it scales as separation to the fourth power, whereas this viscous process is just 8 squared, but it still works. Okay, the question is, how long does it take? Before I show you that, let me quickly show you what's happening to the disk. So these are slices from the simulation that you just saw. These are for different mass ratios for the black holes. Okay, and this is the surface mass density of the disk as a function of radius. So the green time slices are early time slices, and the red ones are later time slices. Notice that you've opened up a gap. So you have disengaged the inner part of the accretion disk where you've started filing mass to the center. So this is the gas in the disk. And the black hole is moving along, right? The secondary is moving towards the primary. And you have disengaged the outer disk. So the outer disk is now frozen, and it's no longer relevant. It's all the time scales of the inner, the dynamical time scale of the inner disk, which is very, very short, that is relevant for the merger. And so you may ask, how long does it take? So it appears it takes a few times 10 to the 7 years, which is great, which is very, very short. And it's not instantly, but it's very short. So you may ask, OK, that's great, if gas works. But is there any particular signature that one can come up with to show that gas is actually implicated in the merger of a particular binary? Now, if the gas disk drives the merger, one can expect, because you saw that we were exciting density waves in the accretion disk. And I showed you the particular case of a circular orbit. So the question is, what happens if you drop the secondary on an eccentric orbit? Because then your resonances will change, and your the spiral density waves that you produce in the disk will be different. And it turns out that in accretion disk, if you start with an eccentric orbit, you actually grow the eccentricity when you're in the viscosity-dominated phase. You tend to accentuate the eccentricity all the way in till you reach the point where gravitational radiation takes over. Once gravitational radiation takes over as the primary angular momentum loss mechanism, your eccentricity damps down exponentially. So if you start out with a system that has a gas-driven in spiral in which the eccentricity has initially grown, then at final merger, you are likely to have a surviving small non-zero eccentricity. The reason this is interesting is because LISA claims that they can detect very small eccentricities, okay, from their fits, template fits. So this is just to show you that as a for the case within the viscous accretion disk, as you are plowing through, you actually the eccentricity grows from the initial eccentricity. So let me just show you a quick movie to show that basically the general behavior is the same as before. You do merge and you merge fast and all of that, but the eccentricity gets accentuated, okay, as you go in. And once you reach the gravitational wave driven in spiral, your eccentricity damps. Gee, I should show them side by side, maybe easier to see. But anyway, it turns out that after you've grown the eccentricity in the viscous mode, once you are gravitationally gravitational wave loss dominated, your eccentricity damps down, and you end up with some non-zero eccentricity at 1 year before the final coalescence. Okay, and this is something they can see in the Church signal. Okay, that hence the calculation. It is very, very interesting that. Therefore, if you see a binary that has a finite eccentricity at the end, it's very strong evidence that gas is implicated in the merger. Because stellar dynamical processes will not systematically increase the eccentricity or decrease it, because it's random. It may not, you know, it will not affect the eccentricity that much, whereas the gas will systematically increase the eccentricity, and then gravitational wave losses will damp it down in an exponential fashion. So the key points here are that you will have electromagnetic counterparts or precursors. You may have afterglows because you have this huge amount of gas that's piled in the center. The surface mass density of the disengaged inner disk is very, very high in the center. And all of that gas is going to be accreted onto the merged black hole. So you would see a very strong afterglow. So you would see it in the X-ray, preferably, we think. And you would also see The problem, as I said, with LISA is that LISA will not identify the host galaxies where the merging is happening. So you need all these other spirals to look at. And there are, of course, other suggestions that have been made about, what impulsive changes in the spins of these merging black holes will also be manifest. That's not something we have incorporated in our simulations. They're too simple to include black hole spin, so on and so forth. So what we are claiming is that the final eccentricity before the merger is going to be indicative of a gas disk having affected the merger. And it's much more effective for low mass ratio binaries, these extreme mass ratio binaries, or EMRIs, as they are called. So let me conclude my talk. So here are sort of the take-home points. I'm not going to go through them. I think I've made all these bold claims already, so I'll just stop here. Thank you very much.
Do you have some questions?
So one thing I was a bit confused about, I thought early on in the talk when we were motivating the sort of formation of more massive black holes in the six range, you said that the top three model, where there are only 100 solar masses, couldn't do the job. Mm-hmm. Then later on, you seem to be saying that, well, most of the mass buildup is actually by this
accretion.
Gas being driven in through accretion. And so what I took out of that was maybe the original seed mass doesn't matter so much. Is that
no, actually it does, because the accretion is still on to the seed. So it turns out that if you start out with 100 solar mass seeds versus a 10 to the 4 solar mass seeds, bringing them up with E-foldings and saltpeter time with every accretion episode to 10 to the 9 solar masses. So when I'm making that comparison, I'm still falling in the fact that it is still accretion that is growing each of these. It's just that if I populate the same significance peaks, greater than 3.5 sigma peaks, at redshift 10, 20, or 25, whatever have you, I don't have enough of these in the population 3 model to match the abundance of observed 10 to the 9 solar mass errors. Okay, because the mass function of the population 3 model seeds is something that looks basically like a Doppler function at, you know, a few hundred solar masses, 100 to 500. Okay, and it turns out that what doesn't work there is that if you populate, if you need to populate every 1.5 sigma peak in order to produce enough of these. And these 1.5 sigma peaks actually have a density in the center that is too low to get a galaxy going, let alone, you know, any gas collapsing. So you cannot, and it turns out now the current simulations also show that the dark matter halos, which do form the first seeds, the most likely scenario is that those black holes are actually ejected. Because when you go supernova, you get rid of all the gas, the remnant actually is thrown out of the dark matter halo. So you don't actually see very efficiently either, even if you assume. So it turns out now that the current simulation suggests that you actually seed very few of these, if at all. And the problem becomes even more severe because you have very few of them to start with. And so you can't even grow, you can't grow enough of them in an extreme fashion to get them to 10 to the 9 solar masses. So it's still accretion. The argument is still about accretion.
Why can't you directly form
smaller
black holes during the collapse phase or as the gas collapses in one of these mergers? I mean, why is the seed relevant? Why not just form the black hole later on?
As in, but what do you mean by later on? But that's what we are doing, right? Well, that's what the gas is collapsing.
How the gas come in? But in your model, so for example, you said there was
a pre-galactic disk.
Yeah, but so these two disks combine and...
No, there's one disk.
When there's a merger.
I don't know, but good point. So you have a halo that forms a single pre-galactic disk. Mm-hmm. That disk collapses and forms a black hole seed. And all of this happens fast enough on a time scale that's shorter than the time before the first merger occurs. So then the next merger occurs. So you, at this point, what you have is a seed black hole and some stars and another halo with either another seed black hole or not. All you need at this point in effecting the merger is you need to supply a little more gas to the center.
So I'm saying, why not just combine those two halos without any black holes and just make a black hole at that point?
Sure, we could do that. I mean, that would just be a recreation of this scenario, where this is going to be produced later on. But there's a timing issue as well, because you still need to. So if you look at the frequency, the mergers are very, very frequent at extremely high redshift, but still the timing argument doesn't allow you to form enough, to grow enough of them to 10 to the 9 by 2 gigayears. So it's a combination of the timing argument and the abundance of significance peaks. And the abundance of significance peaks has a direct bearing on the merger rate. Because you know the merger rate is a function of the significance of the peaks for dark matter halos.
So one of the things that confused me is you said that your models predict a fewer low, there's somehow a cutoff at low mass.
As well.
Are you sure that the gas can't fragment on small scales and form new low mass black holes?
I think the efficiencies that we infer suggest that very low mass halos are just not going to be able to form black holes. And so they would be halos that, A, were very low mass, therefore either never formed a black hole, and in addition, had very quiet merging histories. Because you could acquire the hole by merging as well. So they would not have, so we get a population of black of halos without central black holes that have that didn't seed them and also didn't garner one by merging.
But do we know enough about the dynamics of this turbulent gas in the process of a merger that we're really sure it's not going to form any small black holes?
I think we will not know. I mean, it could form small black holes, you know, sort of, and stellar remnant black holes. Mm-hmm. They're sort of all there, and they would be wandering in their predictions of them. You know, you could have a lot of very small black holes that are off center, mm-hmm. and, you know, they would be taking time to drift in. Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't be the primary accretors.
Or formed later.
I hate to pick on this, but you know, when you're assuming that there's no metallicity, and of course if you throw just a few metals in, it can change the, you know, your collapse calculations pretty dramatically, especially at later stages. Is there a plan?
No, but at later stages we are no longer the collapse process. You know, this direct formation, this whole thing finishes at redshift 15. It stops because then you've done the seeding, and then you just grow by accretion after that. So we are not continuously forming these seeds at later effects when our metallicity assumption is incorrect. So we stop at redshift 15 or so. We start off with a seed mass function from which is obtained by looking at the dynamics of these halos from redshift 30 down to redshift 15. And then we plant those seeds in the Monte Carlo merger tree and propagate it forward.
But why doesn't it keep on going?
Pardon?
Why doesn't it keep on going? I mean, in your models you stop it there, but in the real universe.
But the metallicity is going to change the collapse and condensation of gas. Mm-hmm. And it's going to, the metallicity is going to affect the criteria. The criteria will no longer be just spin and ratio of T, free burial to T gas, but you will also have the cooling function there.
Right.
So it would be a more complicated case.
No matter how far we look back, we seem to see metals. I mean, we're not back to the Z equals.
We're not back at this episode. Yeah, I'm safe for the moment.
You're safe, but not for long, maybe.
So the metals reduce the efficiency of the cooling? Is that the way it goes?
No, they will form stars more efficiently. Metals will push to form stars more efficiently and therefore funnel mass less efficiently to the central object.
So Lauer has written some papers arguing that, in fact, 10 to the 9 isn't enough, that the objects that you predict have these big black holes are actually, you know, 10 to the 10 and above.
No, they are. This 10 to the 9 is quasars at redshift 6.5.
Okay.
So what we are predicting at redshift 0 is few times 10 to the 10. Okay. Which is consistent with what Lauer came up with.
But Lauer doesn't observe those directly.
He infers it from extending the observed correlation to velocity dispersions that are higher than currently measured and to luminosities that are higher. Absolutely. This is actually, so what we've done is actually shown that there's observational evidence. So if you look at this mass limit, we're talking about it's a log scale. So it's a few times 10 to the 7, 8 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. Of course, it depends on the spin, but you know, it's a weak dependence on the spin of that halo. Remember in the theoretical model that I showed you, the spin dependence was weak. It was minus fifth power or something.
There's OJ-287, which
supposedly OJ-287 is a special case. So this is this very controversial candidate. It's actually a binary. And so, you know, all I'm talking about is for single black holes.
Binaries are nice because you can measure masses with things.
Sure. But you know, but it's very hard. It's much harder to interpret what the variability of those binaries is actually telling us. So yeah, it's off. But yeah, OJ-287. Is this, I think you can call it a Finnish object, right? It's Valtonen and company. It's like the Finns have been following it for years and nobody else seems to have data other than them. I'm not casting any aspersions on them, but you know, it's the Finnish object.
Finnish object. Okay, I think let's thank Priya again.
Thank you.